Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, November 21st. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. Before we get into the news, a brief look at the weather. Today, it's going to be mostly cloudy, a little bit breezy, with a high in the low 40s, same tomorrow, with isolated showers, and on Monday, partly cloudy as well. The temperatures are consistent pretty much with the highs and lows for this time of year. You want to compare, a record high was 67 in 1990 and a record low of zero in 1937. As with most publications, the Gazette's primary focus seems to be the COVID virus, so we will start with their lead story on the front page under the title Schools Plead, Keep Kids Safe Over Holiday. And this is from Grace King of the Gazette. As Thanksgiving approaches, Eastern Iowa schools are asking families to consider students when making their holiday plans by staying home, social distancing, and wearing masks to help slow the spread of COVID-19 and get kids back in the classroom. College Community Superintendent Doug Wheeler said there's a, quote, healthy level of concern, end quote, of people gathering together over the holiday and unwittingly spreading the coronavirus before students are expected to return November 30th. The district joined many schools across the state amid the rampant spread of the virus in moving to temporary virtual learning, planning to resume in-person classes after Thanksgiving break. Wheeler said, a definite concern is people taking advantage of online learning by extending vacations. We're online because we have to be, not because we want to be. Linn County is experiencing a steady increase in positive coronavirus tests, and Iowa has seen 12 days so far this month where more than 4,000 people a day are newly confirmed to have the disease. Linn County Public Health is urging residents to celebrate Thanksgiving virtually or only with members of their own household. In a news release this week, Linn County Public Health said the risk of being exposed to COVID-19 increases dramatically when people spend time inside with people from different households. Holiday guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is not to travel for Thanksgiving and to celebrate at home only with the people you live with. Wheeler said what we've seen in the last couple weeks, maybe that has re-engaged people's concern about who will be safer over the holidays and adjust their plans. Wheeler, who said he usually travels within the state for Thanksgiving, said he would definitely not travel out of the state or get on a plane at this time and is sticking around home. Even when students are in class in person, that's only 7 hours of their day. Wheeler said, we rely a lot on our community and making good decisions the other 17 hours of the day we don't have students. I'm really making a personal plea. Our staff is impacted by this. Our students are impacted by this. Our families are impacted by this. And I think if you talk to any superintendent in the state, they would probably say these are the toughest decisions we've ever had to make. In a letter to the community earlier this month, Cedar Rapids Community School District Superintendent Noreen Bush wrote that everyone is facing a tough decision about being with extended family members this holiday. She wrote, we desperately want to have our kids re-enter our schools after Thanksgiving. For that to happen, we need to see the trend of positive COVID-19 cases decline, and the healthcare system needs to be stabilized and less taxed. Please take the safety measures when you are with others outside of your immediate household, so we can stabilize our community and bring our kids back to school, end quote. The students are an example every day of what adults need to do to curb the spread of the coronavirus, Bush said, by wearing a mask, sanitizing, and washing their hands, social distancing, and staying home if they're not feeling well. Cedar Rapids schools are in virtual learning through November 30th. The district is expected to make a decision next week about applying for a second waiver from the Iowa Department of Education that would allow students to remain on virtual learning longer. Also on the Gazette's front page is an article from Aaron Jordan under the title COVID-19 Claims First State Prison Worker. 8 prisoners so far and the first prison staff member this week have died of COVID-19 as outbreaks continue at Iowa's prison facilities. Danny Homan, president of AFSCME Council 61, the union representing state correctional workers, among others, said it's a mess. The straw that broke the camel's back is what happened with the passing of a correctional officer. An officer at the Iowa Correctional Institution at Mitchellville died Monday, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections COVID-19 website. This is the first state corrections staff death from the virus. No other details were available about the officer. Overall, 442 Iowa prison staff have tested positive for COVID-19, with about 3/4 having recovered as of late Thursday. Of the 104 staff who are still sick, 37 are from the Anamosa State Penitentiary, which has been dealing with a major outbreak since early November. In cases where it's likely an employee contracted the virus at work, the state allows the employee to use paid administrative leave as opposed to sick or vacation leave, said Corrections Department spokesman Cord Overton. Maintaining adequate prison staffing has been a challenge during outbreaks, he said. Quote, as the virus impacts some prisons' overall staffing levels, facilities may exercise pre-developed staffing plans to ensure safety of the institution can be maintained even when staffing levels are not ideal, end quote. In some cases, the Corrections Department has used temporary staffing companies to supplement regular medical staff, he said. Overall, 3,025 Iowa prison offenders have tested positive for COVID-19, with 536 of those people still positive and 2,489 recovered, the state reported late Thursday. The total number is about 40% of the total prison system population of 7,431. Anamosa had 235 COVID-19 positive offenders late Thursday. This is about 1/4 of the total population. The prison had 37 staff infected with the disease, the state reported. David Allen Streets, age 70, died November 8th. Jonathan William Strain, 59, died Monday, and Robert William Sorovi, age 64, died Tuesday. All died at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics where they had been transferred after their symptoms worsened. Citing security reason, Overton would not say how many offenders from Anamosa or overall in the system are being treated at hospitals. But he did say, I will tell you that during the past several weeks, the department has typically had between 5 to 15 inmates receiving hospital care at a given time. The department has reduced offender transfers in and out of the prisons to prevent new introductions of the virus, Overton said. But Sue McTaggart said her son, who was an offender at the Anamosa prison, was transferred to the Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility earlier this summer to keep the kitchen running, according to a report by Iowa Public Radio. 2 dozen more men were transferred from Mount Pleasant to Anamosa this month to help with kitchen work during the outbreak, IPR reported. Homan said he's been hearing from prison staff about their concerns about the outbreaks in facilities. He said, in our opinion, management within the DOC is doing little to nothing constructive to stop the spread of COVID-19 inside our facilities. We have much more COVID-19 news, but let's take a break here with an article titled Regents Again Take on Campus Free Speech, written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Dateline Iowa City. With First Amendment issues churning at Iowa's public universities, including controversial coursework, spurned student groups, and contentious social media posts, the Board of Regents has created a committee to review its free speech policy and evaluate its campus's compliance. Additionally, Board President Mike Richards this week tasked the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa presidents to provide an update at the board's February meeting, quote, on exactly how each institution is protecting free speech on campus and in the classroom. Richards said everyone has the right to express their own opinion. Disagreeing on issues and having a respectful debate about those issues should happen on our university campuses. What should not happen is preventing another person or group's opinion from being expressed or threatening those opinions with possible repercussions. This is not who we are, and it is not right, end quote. Richards, in making his comments, didn't reference any particular incident on the campuses his board oversees, although there have been many First Amendment and free speech-related debates and concerns. But he noted the board last year adopted a free speech policy after both ISU and the UI ended up in court over separate issues, prompting legislatures to enact a new law on speech and expression at public institutions of higher education in the state of Iowa. The board's committee of three regents will evaluate implementation of its new policy, Regents David Barker, Nancy Botker, and Zach Leist, the board's student regent from ISU, also will research best practices at other institutions and recommend changes that need to be made to strengthen our efforts on free speech, Richard said. He continued, this board will not tolerate the violation of anyone's freedom of speech on our campuses. The most recent debate involves ISU and its college Republicans. After the presidential election this month, the student GOP group issued a tweet that some saw as a call to violence. Quote, everyone, you must arm up. Expect these people to attempt to destroy your life. The elites want revenge on us, it said. The tweet initially elicited condemnation from ISU leaders. A spokeswoman, according to media reports, said, any suggestion of armed activity by an Iowa State student organization is prohibited by university policy. But a condemnation was insufficient for dozens of ISU students, faculty, staff, and alumni who wrote an open letter demanding a stronger response, including amending the code of conduct and deregistering the group for now. But ISU leaders refused to go that far, arguing, quote, doing so would violate their First Amendment rights, end quote. Just before that, on another campus, UNI President Mark Nook intervened to allow a student group opposing abortion rights on campus after student government initially refused, labeling it a, quote, hate group, likening it to a, quote, white supremacist group, and calling its approval a, quote, smack in the face, end quote, to women's rights. Nook determined the student leaders had not been content neutral in denying the Students for Life of America application and granted it student organization status and the access to campus resources that comes with it. In his 8-page reversal, Nook wrote, universities exist to give students and all members of the university community an opportunity to wrestle with a vast diversity of ideas and opinions, to challenge their perception of their own identity and the beliefs and opinions of others, and to grow in their understanding of natural and social systems, end quote. Also this semester, ISU faced backlash over an English professor's syllabus warning that students could be dismissed for othering, expressing views deemed racist, sexist, or homophobic. She warned students could not choose for papers or projects any topic that takes at its base that one side doesn't deserve the same basic human rights as you do, that is, no arguments against gay marriage, abortion, Black Lives Matter, and so forth. And in August, a UI professor apologized after asking students, quote, to decide between being a slave or slave master for a 12-page paper, end quote. The apology came after a Black student told about it on Twitter. Iowa lawmakers last year enacted a measure that, among other things, directed the Board of Regents to adopt a new speech and expression policy for its campuses. The board, in April 2019, adopted policies committing it to its proper role of encouraging diversity of thoughts, ideas, and opinions, and peaceful, respectful, and safe exercise of First Amendment rights. The region's policy explicitly prohibits universities from denying, quote, benefits or privileges available to student organizations based on the viewpoint of a student organization or the expression of the viewpoint by the student organization, end quote. The policy comes after the UI had been sued by two faith-based student organizations deregistered for barring from leadership positions individuals who didn't align with their beliefs. According to the new regent's policy, the university shall not deny any benefit or privilege to a student organization based on the organization's requirement that the leaders of the organization agree to and support its beliefs. Student organizations may, but are not required to, limit leadership positions to students who, upon individual inquiry, affirm that they support the organization's beliefs and agree to further the organization's mission. Richards, in his statement about free speech on the campuses, said that this is an issue we must address and a conversation that should be transparent and public. The Iowa Today page contains an article that's a little bit lengthy, and it's compiled by the Gazette's fact checker team. The fact checker team, it says, checks statements made by an Iowa political candidate or office holder or a national candidate or office holder about Iowa or in ads that appear in the Gazette's market. They say that claims must be independently verifiable, and they ultimately give statements grades from A to F based on accuracy and context. And with that in mind, they have provided this article titled, How Does Iowa's COVID-19 Testing Stack Up? Iowa's response to the spread of COVID-19 once again is in the spotlight as infections surge across the United States. Governor Kim Reynolds, in a November 10th news conference, said of the state's testing availability, "So Iowans, I think we've tested 1 in 3. Our numbers, when we look at every type of test that we're utilizing, we are way at the top compared to other states." So this is their analysis. Reynolds' first statement in this two-part claim is correct, according to the state's COVID-19 dashboard. The number of Iowans tested as of last week when she made the claim was nearly 1.07 million. That number was about 1.15 million as of Friday. Iowa's population is estimated at 3.15 million, according to the U.S. Census data. So, this does mean 1 of 3 Iowans have been tested for COVID-19. It should be noted, this figure covers people tested over more than 8 months since the disease was confirmed in Iowa, not just recently. The governor's next claim about how Iowa compares with other states on administering COVID-19 tests is not as simple to prove. Pat Garrett, Reynolds Communications Director, said she was including PCRs and other antigen and rapid tests conducted in Iowa in both her claims. According to the Food and Drug Administration, these tests are used to diagnose COVID-19 cases, the former being a molecular test that detects the virus's genetic material, and the latter detecting specific proteins from the virus. While the antigen tests, typically used in congregate settings such as long-term care facilities, produce results faster, the agency says they are less accurate. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance defines a confirmed case as one that was diagnosed with a molecular test, while cases diagnosed with antigen tests are presumptive positives. These are limitations to the dashboards compiled by the public, journalists, and public health experts showing how states stack up against one another on testing. Some dashboards show how many total tests and tests per capita states have conducted, but not all states include all available types of tests in their reported data. A Kaiser Health News analysis released in September showed that 22 states and Washington, D.C. either do not report antigen tests or count antigen positives as COVID-19 cases. States also may report antigen tests as separate and not in their total of tests administered. Publicly available data shows more of a grim picture of testing in Iowa. The Washington Post, using data from the COVID-19 tracking project, reports Iowa ranks among the bottom 10 of states in tests administered per capita. The COVID-19 Tracking Project, a volunteer organization launched by The Atlantic, pulls data directly from state public health departments, so however those agencies report their data is what is used to calculate the totals. This initiative's data is used by most major media outlets and academic sources, including the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center. Based on this data, The fact checker previously has found that Iowa was below the testing target for each state from the Harvard Global Health Institute. However, Paul Trombino, Reynolds' chief operations officer, told KCRG TV9 last month the number of tests conducted each week in Iowa is twice as high as what is logged on the website. Iowa reports only the number of individuals tested and does not make public its data on the total tests administered, the state's way of filtering out multiple tests run on one person. For instance, U.S. Health and Human Services data shows 1.8 million PCR tests administered as of November 17th in Iowa. The state publicly reported 1.02 million of those tests, about 54%. Antigen tests would be in addition to those PCR tests. The COVID-19 tracking project notes these discrepancies, and according to the initiative, Iowa and only 8 other states report testing totals using unique people rather than test specimens or encounters, which are unique people tested on a given day. The total encounters over time may include people who already have been tested, unlike Iowa's method of counting. Atlantic journalist Alexis Madrigal, one of the initiative's co-creators, told the fact-checker that states that report people tested like Iowa show far lower per capita testing rates than those that report in-test specimens or encounters. This means Iowa's method of reporting can explain why it ranks so low using publicly available data. Madrigal said it could be that Iowa is doing a great job testing, but we cannot know that through our methods. Some researchers have criticized the federal government for not sharing much of the COVID-19 data it collects, making it unclear to them how the task force calculates this figure. While the White House does not make all reports public, the Center for Public Integrity attempts to compile them as they are sent to governors. Even in its most recent available report of all 50 states, Iowa, from September 20th, Iowa is marked as dark green in this metric. Its test administered per capita fell below only 9 other states. And so, this fact-checker team concludes, Reynolds' claim that 1 in 3 Iowans have been tested over time is correct, though it sheds little insight on the current state of testing in Iowa. And the White House, using privately maintained data, reports Iowa is among the top of the 50 states for its number of tests administered per 100,000 residents. But without a clear, publicly available data set, there are major discrepancies that make it difficult to draw comparisons in how states handle the virus. Because it's plausible, Iowa could be performing better than publicly shared data suggests, but we cannot prove it. We give the governor a B. Looking at a little more local news before we get to the editorials, here is one from Kat Russell titled, Man Taken to Hospital After Cedar Rapids House Fire. Firefighters responded to a fire Friday morning that damaged a residence and sent a man to a hospital. Cedar Rapids firefighters were dispatched about 9:30 a.m. to a 1.5-story residence at 111 Kenmore Street Northeast for reports of a basement fire. When they arrived, firefighters saw smoke coming from the home. While firefighters attacked the blaze, a 58-year-old man was found outside with soot on his face. Emergency medical care was administered, and he was taken to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital for treatment. No other occupants were found inside, firefighters said. The residence suffered heavy fire, heat, and smoke damage to the basement and smoke damage to the first floor, the fire department said. And Kat Russell has reported on another fire. Fire damages popular Halloween haunt in Central City. The Circle of Ash, a popular Halloween haunt at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Central City, caught fire Friday. Significant damage was reported. Deputies and firefighters from Central City, Alvernette, Coggin, and Prairieburg were dispatched at 11:44 a.m. to the Linn County Fairgrounds at 201 Central City Road, the Linn County Sheriff's Office said. Firefighters found a generator and an adjacent enclosed trailer, which contained property belonging to the haunted attraction, had caught fire. The fire spread to other trailers that contained props and to a wooded area before it was extinguished. No injuries were reported. And one last article, this is from Lee Hermiston, Clive Man 21 found dead in burning vehicle after crash near Lake McBride. A Clive man was found dead this week in a burning vehicle near Lake McBride State Park. Johnson County Sheriff's Office said deputies were called at 11:23 p.m. Sunday to a vehicle crash near the entrance to Lake McBride. Deputies found a vehicle that was on fire. The lone occupant of the vehicle, later identified as Connor Mall, age 21, died at the scene. The crash is under investigation by the Sheriff's Office, Solon Fire Department, Johnson County Ambulance Service, and Johnson County Medical Examiner's Department. From the Gazette's Insight page, they've printed a guest editorial out of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that had appeared in that publication's Wednesday edition, and it's titled, "Thank You, Election Workers." If you think it was stressful waiting for election boards around the country to count the millions of votes in the presidential election, imagine being the workers who were doing the counting. Or imagine being the poll workers who braved exposure to the coronavirus to man polling places that were swamped with early voters and election day crowds. Think of the many hours of work done by election staffers who planned for election like no other in the middle of a pandemic. All of these workers faced a daunting challenge, and they rose to the occasion, working through the night in many cases and diligently counting away so that everyone's vote counts this year. In some cases, these people still are at work and will be for days to come. Their efforts are heroic as the other essential workers of this pandemic. In big convention centers and small county offices, Republicans and Democrats worked side by side to make sure that American democracy was protected. In most cases, their election operations had never had to deal with the number of mail-in ballots they received this year or the number of in-person voters who showed up, and no one working on elections had ever before had to work through the challenges that were created by the coronavirus pandemic. Polling places had to be moved to locations with more space to spread out voting machines and voters. An army of new poll workers had to be recruited to handle the extra work and to replace the veteran, mostly older, poll workers who could not safely work the polls this year. Every aspect of the operation had a new added degree of difficulty this year, and, as expected, when the ballot counting took longer than it typically does, tensions began to run high. Even so, from state to state, poll workers put on their glasses, hunkered over counting tables, and diligently worked their way through ballots. You could see it in their faces. Every vote is going to count. America always owes a debt of gratitude to these election workers, but that is even more true this year. Too often, we take their efforts for granted. This year was a reminder. Democracy works because of their work. The community letter the Gazette has published today on its Insight page comes from Ralph Plagman, P-L-A-G-M-A-N, of Cedar Rapids, and it is contributed under the title An Open Letter to Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst. Mr. Plagman says, "It is time for you to refute President Donald Trump's repeated assertion that the 2020 election was stolen, fraudulent, or rigged. Consider the following. Number one, Trump's own Department of Homeland Security has said that the election of 2020 was the most secure in American history. Number two, Trump's legal challenges have mostly been dismissed by the courts. Any discrepancies are so small as to have no impact on the outcome in any jurisdiction. Number three, on November 9th and 10th, the New York Times contacted top election officials in all 50 states. None reported any major voting issues. Only Texas did not respond. Number four, H.R. McMaster and John Bolton, Trump's first two national security advisors, have both said unequivocally that Trump's claims that the election was stolen from him are false and irresponsible. The election of 2020 was amazing. Despite a raging pandemic, there was a record turnout. And Republicans did very well in the Senate, House, governor, and state legislature races. Trump lost because more than 5 million voters preferred Joe Biden for president. Trump supporters have every right to be disappointed and angry their candidate lost. Clinton supporters felt the same way in 2016. But Trump's assertion that the election was stolen is dangerous. It also is disrespectful to his voters. He knows better. And he is deliberately misleading the good people who voted for him. Please speak up for our democracy and repudiate these false claims. Your calming words would mean so much to Iowans of all political persuasions. And again, that's been contributed by Ralph Plagman of Cedar Rapids. Before we move to the obituaries, this is a reminder that you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, November 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. We'll start with the short notices first. Lois M. Fugelsang, age 89, died Wednesday, November 18th. Her arrangements are being handled through Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. And from West Liberty, Harold Detweiler Jr., also known as Buzz, age 64, died Thursday, November 19th. Those arrangements are being made through Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty. Lorraine Schneider died Thursday, November 19th, and arrangements are pending with the family. From Independence, Mary Lou Covault, age 85, died Monday, November 9th. The Rife Family Center in Independence is assisting the family. In Iowa City, Barbara June Hunt, age 87, died Thursday. Her arrangements are being handled through Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Alice E. Conant of Lamont, age 99, died Friday. Arrangements are being made through Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home in Olwine. And from Marion, Betty Karsner, age 91, died Friday. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is handling those arrangements. Mark Dramstad, age 66, died Tuesday, November 17th. Arrangements are being made through Jameson Schmidt Funeral Home in Olwine. And from West Branch, Robert Allen Klein, age 78, died Wednesday, November 18th, and his arrangements are being handled through Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch. Moving to the longer obituaries, from Cedar Rapids, Francis M. Burr, B-U-R-R, died at the age of 72 last Thursday from lung cancer. The obituary states he wished to be cremated, have no funeral service, and was adamant about not having any military honors. The family does invite people to leave a message or tribute to the Burr family on the website of iowacremation.com under obituaries. Also from Cedar Rapids, Marianne Sargent, age 72, of Cedar Rapids, died last Wednesday. Her celebration of life will be held at a later date. They give no other details. From Cedar Rapids, Shirley V. Langton, age 96, died November 17th at Heritage Woods of Belvedere, Illinois. Graveside services are at 11 a.m. Tuesday at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Per her request, there will be no visitation, and Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of those arrangements. They offer anyone who wishes to do so to leave a message or tribute to the family on the webpage for cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. From Grundy Center, Laura Townsend Edler, age 55, of Gladbrook, passed away Wednesday, November 18th, at Grundy County Memorial Hospital in Grundy Center. Her memorial service will be this coming Monday at 11 a.m. at Anderson Funeral Homes in Marshalltown. Visitation will be 10 a.m. until time of the service. Due to concerns regarding COVID-19, the family encourages the use of Anderson Funeral Homes live stream to view the service. The link will be able to be accessed off of the Anderson Funeral Home Facebook page at the time of the service. You may send your online condolences to Anderson FHS, FHS.com, excuse me. From Independence, Harold D. Jacobs, age 83, died this past Thursday at the Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. tomorrow, November 22nd, at the Rife Family Center in Independence, with a graveside service at 11 a.m. this coming Monday at the Walker Cemetery in Walker. From Toddville, Richard A. Hemphill, age 76, passed away last Sunday, November 15th, at Willow Gardens Care Center in Marion. Per his wishes, there will be no public services. A private family graveside service will be held at Lafayette Cemetery in Alburnett, and Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. In Marion, Richard M. Sundermeyer passed November 18th at his home. A private family service will be held, but memorials can be sent to Lutheran Church of the Resurrection or Mercy Hospice. One other brief notice here, and then a longer obituary, is Carol Ann Clark, age 77, passed away at home Tuesday, November 3rd. The only thing that is referenced here is that a celebration of life will be held at a later date. And the final obituary in today's Gazette is for June Penelope Watson, also known as Penny, age 80, of Iowa City, passed away Sunday, October 4th at Atrium Village in Hills, Iowa. Here are the details. A celebration of Penny's life will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, November 28th at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church at 140 Gathering Place Lane in Iowa City. They will have a visitation time from 11 a.m. Saturday until the service is at the church, but the service will be live streamed on Saturday afternoon and can be viewed at the service time or any time thereafter. It looks like you would, if you wanted to participate through the live stream, you would go to the church's Facebook page and go to a search for Remembering Penny Watson and then request to join the group. They also indicate that memorial donations can be made in her memory to St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, Iowa City Animal Care and Adoption Center, Iowa City Public Library, or the Iowa chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We'll move to sports now. There's not a lot of sports, but here's an article, High School Football Class 2A Championship, and it's titled Champions Creed, and it is from Jeff Linder. Dateline Cedar Falls. Creed Welch never had a doubt he was going to play, and he was going to be on the field at the end. No way he was going to miss all of the fun. He said, "I wasn't going to sit out. No way." After 5 days of physical therapy, a knee brace, then a light workout, Welch put his fingerprints all over the Class 2A state championship football game. He passed for 169 yards and a touchdown and intercepted 3 passes to lead 4th-ranked walk-on past number 3 Central Lion George Little Rock 28-14 on Friday at the Unidome. Walk-on coach Chad Bierman said, "I wasn't planning on using him on defense. I really don't know how he got out there." Welch said, "Here's how. I just like to play football." Walk-on at 10-1 won its 10th consecutive game and claimed its 2nd state championship. The Indians went all the way in 2017, reached the semifinals in 2018, then lost in last year's final. No denying them this time. "My brother, Michael Sweeney, was on the 2017 team, and I told him I was going to win one, too," said Brennan Sweeney, whose heads-up play turned a lateral pass by Lions quarterback Zach Luttmer into a 27-yard fumble return for a touchdown to start the scoring. Welch's left leg was injured, both knee and ankle, in the 2nd quarter of Saturday's semifinal win over Monroe PCM. He said, "I was laying pretty low most of the week. I didn't do much. Last Sunday I was checked by the doctor, then it was physical therapy, Monday and Tuesday. I got a brace for my knee Tuesday, and I was able to come back to practice by Thursday." Bierman said, "We put him through some motions Wednesday and Thursday, and he split the reps at quarterback Thursday with Sean Cooper. Walk-On led 16-14 at halftime, thanks to Sweeney's unlikely score, a 7-yard touchdown run by Pat Hennessy, and a pair of 2-point runs by Ethan O'Neill. That offset a pair of TD runs by Luttmer, a very talented sophomore quarterback for CLGLR at 11-1. The second half belonged to the Indians, and it started with Welch's arm. Lined up on the left side of the formation, Welch took a handoff and heaved a bomb to Braxton Stewart, who completed a 56-yard scoring play to extend Walk-On's advantage to 22-14. Welch said, "We did that in the semifinals my sophomore year here. We put it in last week, but didn't get a chance to run it. Braxton came through the clutch." Central Lyon GLR didn't drive inside the Walk-On 35 in the second half, and Welch killed 2 Lions drives with interceptions. After one, he retweaked his knee and missed most of a series before returning. He wasn't going to miss those glorious final minutes. After Welch's final pick, the Indians drove 58 yards in 8 plays, clinching the outcome with a 6-yard touchdown run by O'Neill with 1:39 left. O'Neill said, "This is insane," as he ran for 406 yards. He said, "We've worked for this for 4 years. It started in the weight room when we were freshmen. CLGLR is a tough team, but the conditioning we do, it allows us to be dominant at the end of the game." And he finally said, "We've worked for this for 4 years." One other small high school sports reminder. Out of Cedar Rapids, the Mississippi Valley Conference has released its guidelines for winter sports. Following an edict from the governor, there shall be only 2 spectators per athlete as a limit. Masks are required at all MVC venues at all times, it says. This includes boys and girls basketball, boys and girls bowling, boys swimming, and wrestling. And they say that the complete list of COVID-19 guidelines can be found at the MississippiValleyIowa.org website. Normally, we emphasize high school sports and prep kinds of athletic activities, but there is an article here from the Gazette on College Athletics titled "Midwest Conference is Working on Return." This is from Justin Webster of the Gazette, and it says presidents from Midwest Conference schools, including Jonathan Brand of Cornell College in Mount Vernon, have been trying to work out a plan to return to competition in 2021 after officially postponing all winter sports through the end of 2020. Seth Wing, director of athletics for Cornell since the beginning of July and the Rams' head baseball coach for the past decade, said, "Our winter sports currently have competition suspended through January 1st. Our presidents are meeting on December 2nd to talk through NCAA and conference protocols to evaluate where we're at with the spread of COVID-19 in our communities and to assess our ability to leave campus and travel to play one another," end quote. If and when sports return on the small college level will be determined by several factors, Wing said. He continued, "We have to decide, 1, are we okay to play sports financially? And then, 2, is it okay from a campus community perception to be able to do this? We've seen Iowa high schools doing it just fine, but just to comment on that, those students get to go home, while our kids live on campus in the dorm, so it's a different deal," end quote. Another obstacle is financing the required compliance needed to participate. Wing said, quote, "The testing cost is a big issue. You have Northern Iowa, a D1 school, who's not participating this fall because they didn't have the testing plan or the finances to be able to absorb the cost of doing that. For a Division I program not to be able to do that, certainly for a Division III school, it's even harder. Also, how long the season can last once it's started will lean heavily on the actions of the student athletes themselves." Wing continued, "We can't control what our student athletes do when they walk out of the gym, so there isn't any additional way to make them stay in their dorms or go straight to class or practice. They're free to live their lives, but what we can control is our game day." Wing believes it'll come down to the college presidents within our conference. They will have all of the facts in front of them, and we will have very strict game day protocols and screenings that will be in place, end quote. One way teams like Cornell will try to manage its risk of exposure is to keep its circle as small as possible on game days. Wing said there will be an inner bubble which is tested frequently. Those are the people that are going to be allowed in the gym, kind of like the NBA. With us, our inner bubble is our coaches, players, managers, and trainers, and they will all be part of the testing. One advantage Wing has as the director of athletics for a Division III school that larger schools don't have is the possibility of expansion, while other educational institutions are being forced to pick and choose which programs to continue. Wing said with the D3 model, a lot of our athletes help fill the college. The model is set up for success because we aren't having to invest in scholarships for our student athletes. Our scholarships are all based on their merits of academics and service. I could honestly see other divisions going to our model just because they wouldn't have to provide athletic scholarships. End quote. Long story short, football and basketball wouldn't need to support the other sports the school provides. Wing said, we won't have to make any cuts at all. If anything, we would add sports because it helps with overall enrollment of the college. As for predicting the unpredictable, Wing is hopeful for the future. He ended by saying, I think we're in a good position to have some sort of functional baseball season and spring sports in general, just because they're all outdoors and they present such a lower risk. That's the big deal from our standpoint, minimizing the risk of spread, and that's much easier to do outdoors versus indoors. There are a couple of local articles on the business or section of the Gazette. One is titled, Intolerance Gets $160,000 from State. This is from John Stepp of the Gazette. The Iowa Economic Development Authority approved tax credits for Intolerance Contract Manufacturing to build what they're calling a state-of-the-art automated anodized line in Cedar Rapids. The project will create 6 jobs. The Cedar Rapids-based manufacturer, which makes built-to-print plastic and metal products, will receive a little over $102,000 via investment tax credits and almost $58,000 via a sales, service, and use tax refund. The city of Cedar Rapids is expected to also provide nearly $188,000 in tax abatement over the next 10 years, according to an IEDA document. The project, which has an October 2021 completion date, will cost $3.4 million. The funding will allow the company to finish products in Iowa rather than sending them to Minnesota or Illinois. The 6 new jobs will add to Intolerance's 44 existing workforce. Intolerance sells its product to a variety of industries, including aerospace and agriculture. The company started as the Norman Scott Company after Arthur Collins needed a manufacturer to provide specialty screws, knobs, and connectors, according to Intolerance's website. John Stepp has also contributed this article to the business page titled Mad Modern to Close Nubo Storefront. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Mad Modern will close its storefront in the New Bohemia neighborhood and transition exclusively to buy appointment and curbside delivery, the furniture store announced on Facebook. Mad Modern will move out of the store at 227 16th Avenue Southeast on December 1st and keep inventory in a storage unit. The store's owner, Dave Owens, told the Gazette, we were closed down for a while, and that was the way I was able to keep things moving. It wasn't meant to be a long-term solution, but there isn't really an end in sight here. The best way to contact the store is through Facebook or Instagram, he said. Established in 2011, the store specializes in mid-century modern furniture. Owens plans to have a liquidation sale of the items he doesn't plan to take with him to the new location, saying there's going to be some deals for the next couple weekends. After the pandemic, Mad Modern may return to a storefront. Owens said, I enjoy the personal interaction part of it. I have other dealer colleagues that sit in a warehouse and sell things over a computer, but I didn't want to do that. Our final story today is from the Living page of Gazette. It's titled Solving a Family History Puzzle, and we'll learn about a Cedar Rapids woman descended from 20 Mayflower passengers on both sides of her family. This is written by Allison Gowans of the Gazette. In 1620, a group of 102 passengers on the Mayflower landed in what would become the United States. 400 years later, the General Society of Mayflower Descendants estimates that about 35 million people descended from those original pilgrims, and of those, 150,000 of them have joined the society. For Julianne Thomas of Cedar Rapids, tracking down those ancestors has been a fun and challenging exploration of family history. What she found was that she was descended from the Mayflower on both sides of her family. There are 9 passengers on her father's side and 11 on her mother's. She said, "I knew we were connected to the Mayflower, but I didn't know who." The discovery started when a distant cousin on her father's side of the family sent her brother a genealogy report. Julianne said, "I come from a very competitive family on my mother's side." And the report got one of her aunts interested in uncovering their family history. She was convinced they had a Mayflower connection too and wanted to learn more. Her aunt, Gladys Roby, shared a family document that listed Thomas's great-grandmother, Frances Hill Woodard, as descended from Mayflower passengers. To be accepted by the Mayflower Society, they needed to document each ancestor's birth, marriage, and death going back to the Mayflower. She said, "It was really an adventure trying to find what was going on. It was fascinating work, and it took us a long time to particularly get to my great-grandmother. Woodard was the missing link. They couldn't find documentation of her death. She died in Iowa before death records were kept," Thomas said. Thomas started looking for her at the State Historical Center in Des Moines and at the Tama County Historical Society. There, she found a tiny bound pamphlet on cemeteries in western Benton County. Her aunt's name was listed in the index. Woodard was buried in Redmond Cemetery, a tiny, rural, pioneer-era cemetery. Thomas and her late husband went and walked through it to find her grave. "It was truly amazing we could document her date of death by the crude stones that were there," Thomas said. Her aunt became her partner in researching their family. The two traveled to Plymouth, Massachusetts to see where the Mayflower first landed and also traveled to the United Kingdom to research even further back, as well as Norway to track down a different branch of their family tree. Roby died October 26th at age 95. And Thomas said she misses her every day. She hopes documenting their family stories will be a way for future generations, Roby's children and grandchildren and their descendants, to feel connected to her aunt and those who came before her. She also hopes we can take lessons from the stories of the past. One of them she's intent on highlighting this Thanksgiving is that only half the passengers on the Mayflower survived the first year after landing to make it to what has become known as the first Thanksgiving dinner in 1621. Just 4 women survived, including Mary Brewster, one of Thomas's ancestors. She said they waited until times were better to celebrate their Thanksgiving, and I think that's a great message for this time. I think we should take that as a cautionary lesson for this year. With coronavirus case numbers rising, she said she's skipping a meal with her family to celebrate the holiday by herself. Thomas, who now is retired, was the first female pediatrician in Cedar Rapids. She said she feels a connection to her ancestors and the way they lived. "I'm a Puritan through and through and through," she said. "I think the crazy work schedule as a pediatrician, sometimes 60 hours a week, that hard work ethic, I think I've always had that pioneering work ethic and spirit." Thomas graduated from the University of Nebraska before doing pediatric resident training at University of Iowa. Her career included helping develop the neonatal intensive care unit at St. Luke's Hospital and established Camp Tanager's summer camp for children with diabetes. She had a long history of various firsts as a female medical professional within the Iowa area. They started their own medical practice with 3 other female doctors. She said she initially had trouble getting a mortgage for their space, but were told by a bank official, it was because she might get pregnant and abandon the practice. So she says, it's important to tell people it's okay to be bold. As a woman, it's okay to dream big. She says, there's a pioneering spirit in me that makes me take chances. She said she enjoys researching family for some of the same reasons she likes medicine, saying it's like solving a problem or puzzle, trying to put all of it together. I'm very proud of my family history. It's interesting to have that connection to history and historical figures in solving the puzzle and how we're all related. So that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, November 21st. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. We thank you for listening.